Greetings and welcome on board WDKOK Sunrise. I'm Mark Lawrence. We are talking on the news line now with a man we probably met about a decade ago. Brian Schwartz is from the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins, and he is a professor of environmental health and engineering, works with epidemiology and medicine there, and is an MD. So, Dr. Schwartz, thank you so much for calling in today.
You're very welcome.
I do appreciate it. Yeah, you and I probably have not spoken in person, probably 5, 6, 7 years or so, but we did meet you as the Susquehanna River Heartland Coalition got started. You are a professor of population health sciences at Geisinger in Danville, as well as the director of their Environmental Health Institute. So you have been in our area plenty, and of course done a lot of Zooming into our area too, conducting meetings. So folks around here know you, and we know that you're kind of on the same page as some of our good local docs, so we appreciate this. Well, we are going to talk about climate change. The idea for this was suggested on Earth Day by some of the good folks at Geisinger, and that we check in with this health institute that's running there. So introduce our audience to the Environmental Health Institute. They may not be familiar with the fact that this institution is started.
Yeah, Mark, so the Environmental Health Institute at Geisinger was founded in 2007. And we have a group of investigators and staff people and computer programmers and statisticians who work together trying to understand, what is it about environmental conditions and community conditions that contribute to or negatively impact health. And so now we've done a whole bunch of studies in the region. We've looked at the hydraulic fracturing industry. We've looked at industrial farm animal production. We've looked at aspects of built environment. We've looked at the positive benefits that being close to the Susquehanna River may or may not have on health. We've looked at community greenness and parks, and so we're looking at both the positive health enhancing and the negatively impacting features of communities that could impact health. And Geisinger, has an electronic health record that goes back over 20 years now. And we have people in approximately 40 counties in central and northern and northeastern Pennsylvania. So we're able to study a large number of features of the communities in that region.
We want to focus on climate change today and the fact that our planet is getting warmer. There are health impacts being felt globally that we can certainly detect, and that there will be local health impacts if there aren't already. Let's start out with kind of a off-topic question in a manner of speaking. You still need to do convincing to a lot of folks around here. As soon as they heard me say climate change, they said, let's check the scores or whatever. That's not real. We don't have to worry about that. First, the certainty that we are changing the planet's climate.
Yeah, so there's really no scientific uncertainty about that idea. The idea that certain molecules like carbon dioxide, or what we call greenhouse gases, that if emitted in the atmosphere can promote the retention of heat in the lower atmosphere, that idea has been known for 150 years. And, we can measure that heat retention with instruments, and there's really no scientific debate. Really when it comes down to most of climate change, it's really about chemistry and physics. And, these are fundamental laws of nature, and, you can deny chemistry and physics, but it's not going to get you many places. So there's really no scientific uncertainty about the fact that the climate is warming, and also that the hydrologic cycle, aspects of rainfall and drought, extreme weather, these are also connected. So when we say climate change, it's not just about warming, it's also about the hydrologic cycle. No doubt that these things are changing. We have lots of data. It depends on, what you're measuring, but, we have direct temperature measurements going back to about 1880, so 140 years of direct temperature measurements. But then there's a lot of really interesting science where you can use ice core data, from, you know, the very, very thick ice sheets in Antarctica that go back 800,000 years. You can look at the chemistry of the shells of sea organisms. And the bottom line is that our current carbon dioxide concentration of about 420 parts per million is probably the highest it's been in about 3 million years. And the temperature change is a direct result of that.
Now, we just started to talk about maybe getting the pandemic down to a level where it is endemic, and now we have kind of a surge going on, so maybe that was a premature conversation. But when it comes to climate and COVID, there are some connections that relate to our health that you and your peers can talk about.
Yeah, so we learned a number of things over the last couple of years about COVID and a number of sort of features of the way we live. We know, for example, that people stopped driving dramatically back in March of 2020. And, we saw, air pollution concentrations decline globally very quickly. So that was a positive thing. We also saw consumption of fossil fuels decline dramatically. We saw that, we learned that we can get a lot of work done at home, and we learned that the idea that we all have to get in our cars and maybe sit in traffic for an hour each way to work is probably not necessary. And so I think we might see differences in the patterns of work, and that could also help us to decarbonize the transportation sector. Because don't forget, if we want to do something about climate change, we have to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Most of our energy, over 80-85% of it, continues to come from fossil fuels. And if we want to get rid of all that fossil fuel energy, we have to do it in every sector: food and buildings and agriculture and transportation. And so we've learned that different patterns of work may assist with that.
We are starting as a country perhaps to think a little bit less about the exploitation of the planet and resources, a little bit more about stewardship. I know as a person of faith, we find the words creation care coming up now, and so we are talking about this. Are we at some sort of a pivot point? Will this start to stick and we'll start to make progress in the U.S.?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, these issues are still highly politicized, and so the country tends to get some work done during Democratic administrations, but often it's reversed during Republican administrations. So, sort of corporate average fuel economy standards for vehicles was done under Obama, reversed under Trump, decarbonizing the electricity sector done under Obama, reversed under Trump. And so, unfortunately, this remains a highly politicized issue, and that makes doing anything about it difficult, because in November of this year there will be an election, and if government, as is predicted now, changes, then there will be no carbon policy, no environmental policy for the next 2 years. So that's an unfortunate thing. But I do think you're right that we are at a tipping point, at least when we look globally. The whole world, over 195 countries, has signed on to the various climate change agreements. There's growing effort for countries to make various commitments to decarbonizing their economies. I think that in this country, people, if you ask them their attitudes about climate change and the environment, people are noticing that the weather's getting weird. And I think it's starting to take hold. I think that, my brother was diving in Australia. He really hadn't been interested in environmental issues at all. And he dove on the Great Barrier Reef last year and saw the terrible bleaching of the reef there. And bleaching of reefs is a terrible thing globally, because in many places, reefs form the bottom of the food chain in our ocean. And, you know, fish protein used to be a relatively inexpensive source of protein in people's diets around the world. And our coral reefs around the world are in a heap of trouble. And so he saw that, and then he became an activist, at least to some degree, more than he was before, about worrying about the oceans and the things that we're doing to the environment. And so I think there's a lot of things to be optimistic about, but the bottom line is that no country to date has given a really solid blueprint of all the laws and policies and regulations that will get us to, you know, a decarbonized or net zero economy within the next, you know, most people are saying we got to do it by 2050. But there's lots of reason to believe that's not going to be possible. But no country has actually put down a really solid blueprint of how they would actually do it, even though they said they're committed to doing it.
We're on the Newsline now with Dr. Brian Schwartz. He's a professor of environmental health and engineering, epidemiology and medicine at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. He's also a professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at Geisinger and is director of the Environmental Health Institute. Let's talk about the health impacts of climate change. We know a lot of places are getting wetter. Some are getting drier if they already were. Some are just plain getting warmer. Oceans are changing and ocean levels are changing. The health impacts of this, Brian?
So you can think about the health impacts in a number of different ways. You can go from kind of the small scope to the large scope. Let's just start at the large scope for a second. We have to acknowledge that our societies and our economies and our socio-political systems have evolved over the last 10 or 12,000 years in a stable climate. And so the notion that we need a favorable environmental system to have stable human societies is a fundamental premise that I think we have to start off with. And so the implication is, when your environmental system starts encountering lots of problems, you can start seeing connected problems. Let's talk a little bit about that. We already see that migrants at the southern border of the United States have increased. And, you know, we blame that on a bunch of different things, but there's also a lot of scientific evidence that parts of Central America have experienced extreme drought and crop losses. And so we're going to see more and more climate refugees. We saw in Syria, with the Syrian civil war, there's lots of evidence to suggest that that, at least in part, started due to environmental scarcity because of a terrible drought there. And this led to higher food prices and then, you know, sort of social unrest. But what this says is that those people then move. And so migration will be a big part of the next 50 years, and how countries respond to that could set the tone for what our life is like. We see that migration in Europe out of the Middle East led to Brexit and led to a number of authoritarian governments there. So that's the connection of the environmental system to the socio-political system, and that can have all sorts of implications. And we see a similar thing here. So we're also going to see people on the move because of extreme weather. We're going to see people on the move because of sea level rise. And there's been many estimates that tens to hundreds of millions of people will be on the move in the next 50 years. That can lead to all sorts of population health impacts. And so that is a big picture way of sort of thinking about some of these challenges. Now, we can also look at all sorts of, you know, smaller scale kinds of things. So as it gets warmer, air pollution levels can get worse. This can make asthma, other pulmonary diseases, cardiovascular diseases worse. As it gets warmer and wetter in some places, certain vector-borne diseases carried by ticks or mosquitoes could change their distribution, could change their transmission rate. We expect to see with warming and more severe extreme rainfall that we might have more infectious disease risks in water systems. I think we're going to see lots of potential health impacts of climate change from impacts on the food system. And, you know, depending on where in the world you are, there is estimated to be 20-30% declines in the production of certain foodstuffs in certain places. We're also can directly think about, you know, what heat does to health. And there's been a lot of estimates to suggest that there are parts of this planet that will probably become uninhabitable. They'll just be too hot. And, you know, you can use the heat index to think about that. But the bottom line is that when a certain temperature and humidity combination is exceeded, human physiology cannot cool our bodies. And so it's thought that those places will likely empty out of people. And we know the heat wave that occurred in Europe, for example, in 2003, these European countries are among the richest in the world, and yet there were 50,000 deaths one summer in 2003. So there's direct effects of heat over the short term, and then over the long term, people will be on the move. And we know that refugees, migrants, have all sorts of health risks. And then finally, when we wrap all this together, there will be more mental health problems, more stress-related problems, because, again, humanity evolved with a stable climate system, and we're not going to have that going forward.
Do we know that we have had health impacts around here yet?
Well, you know, it's difficult to attribute, you know, one person's disease to climate change. But the bottom line is that we know that we can attribute around the world health impacts to climate change now. This is happening now. And I guess it depends, you know, in central Pennsylvania, you know, luckily there's a pretty good climate. Penn State did a study several years ago that says that probably heavier rainfall will be experienced in central PA, and this will probably lead to more flooding of the Susquehanna. Flooding can cause all sorts of health problems. It can cause direct injury. You know, you see these pictures of torrents coming and wiping out bridges and throwing cars into people. You know, this kind of thing is happening around the world. I haven't seen that in central PA yet, but then these kind of floods can also lead to infectious disease risks over the short term as stormwater systems are sort of flooded with water and sewage and stormwater is mixed, and all these things can happen. So, I mean, we have found that some of the changes in weather patterns. Now, weather is happening what's happening outside your window right now. Climate is really more of the average weather over a much longer period of time, the order of decades. But we've done some analysis with several health conditions that have shown that temperature and humidity in the region can contribute to increased risk of disease. We've also done studies, and you know, so climate change, as I said before, the energy and food systems and how we use land, they're all connected. And so climate change itself is not a separate problem. So the Environmental Health Institute has been looking at the health effects of unconventional natural gas development. That has had some benefits for greenhouse gas emissions because we've seen a number of coal-fired power plants around the country change over to natural gas, which is a cleaner fossil fuel. It still is a carbon dioxide emitter, but it's cleaner in terms of the other pollutants. So that's a positive, but the negative has been that there's been more asthma exacerbations, there's been more hospitalizations for congestive heart failure. And so what this shows is that as we do something about climate change, there will be connected benefits to removing fossil fuels, because fossil fuels affect health in so many ways.
What should I do? Become less dependent on fossil fuels might be a way, right? What else?
When we talk about what we need to do something about climate change, I say we need to do everything. And so we need to think about it as individuals and as families and as communities. and all the way up to local and state and federal government. And so we have to do everything. As individuals, what have I done? Well, I got photovoltaic panels producing electricity on my house. I got hot water solar panels on my house, heating up the water. I have an electric vehicle. I have all of my thermostats on computers so that this house is hotter in the summer and colder in the winter than is usually comfortable for my wife. She usually smacks me in the head because of that, but she's putting up with it. We, you know, they've deregulated the electricity market, so I get all of my electricity from wind. And so those, and then the other big thing that individuals can do is they can think about their diet. The bottom line is that eating lower on the food chain, eating less beef, decarbonizes your diet. It has the additional benefit of being better for health and other reasons too. But you know, I admit I enjoy a good steak. I am not a vegetarian, but I try to think about what I eat as well. I've also changed a lot about my personal travel. Now, I am not telling people that they have to give up all the things they like in life, but you can just think about your travel a bit more. And so I've tried to really manage my work travel, and COVID assisted in that, to a large degree, because work culture has changed as a result of that. So those are some examples. But the bottom line is, as a world, we have to make fossil fuels more expensive. Until fossil fuels are more expensive, there's no incentive to stop burning them. If we make them more expensive, we will stop burning them. And so things like a carbon tax and things like a carbon cap and trade have been discussed. Most of the policies about carbon taxes are that you would get rid of the income tax and you would just have a carbon tax that would be revenue neutral, and that is a regressive tax. It affects the poor more than people who have more socioeconomic resources, and so most of the policies say you have to build into something like that a way to reduce the impacts on the people who are most affected by the increased costs of everything. The more energy that is embedded into an object, the more it will cost if it's made with fossil fuels, if you make fossil fuels more expensive.
Anything to add to our conversation I didn't ask, but you feel it is important for you to say?
I would say that I'm optimistic that we can do something about this. I am optimistic that there's growing recognition that we have to do something about this. I think people in central Pennsylvania should feel some happiness about the fact that they live in a pretty good place regarding expected changes in climate. If I have a grandmother or grandparents who have a house on the coast of Florida right now, I would not feel too good about their long-term prospects and their ability to sell their house later. So I think there's lots of reasons to be optimistic, and I just hope that that your listeners will engage with this issue, and we can work together to make sure that these environmental systems that have allowed humanity to thrive the last 10,000 years will continue in a stable way.
Is there one go-to place that you can suggest that folks get more information about this?
It depends a lot on what they want to learn about, but if people are somewhat skeptical about, whether this is happening or not, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has all of its documents full text online. The U.S. Global Change Research Program has all of its text online. There's a number of websites, Climate Central and others, that talk about, with a questions and answers approach about, why you should believe this and, where the weaknesses are, and it has answers to all those questions. So that's what I would start with. It depends a little bit on what people want to learn about, but there's lots of resources for every single question, but you're not going to find a single source that's good for every question at once.
We have been talking to Dr. Brian Schwartz, professor of environmental health and engineering, epidemiology and medicine at Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins, professor in the Department of Population Health Sciences at Geisinger, and the director of their Environmental Health Institute. Dr. Schwartz, thank you so much for your time and your help and all the information today.
It was nice talking to you again, Mark, and you're very welcome. It was my pleasure.